Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Had everything gone according to schedule, right about now we'd have been bringing you a detailed report on the health of the American banking industry. That's going to have to wait till Thursday, though, as negotiations over those government stress tests continue. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear unique perspectives on global events and American culture at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Monday, everybody. It is the 4th of May today. You remember the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, the original bank bailout? One of the first things the Obama administration wanted to do was convince us it was working, that the basic plan to give banks more money was the right way to go. So almost 3 months ago, the Secretary of the Treasury ordered up these things called stress tests. And yeah, you can think of them as the financial equivalent of running on a treadmill, exams that are supposed to give us an idea of whether a given bank has enough cash to keep on going. I said they're supposed to give us an idea because we don't know yet. The grades were supposed to come out today, but they keep getting delayed as bank executives try to convince the Treasury Department to give them passing scores, that the banks don't need more capital. Adam Posen is the deputy director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. Adam, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
This new capital that the banks are going to have to come up with, some of them anyway, depending on these results come Thursday, is that going to be public money, that is to say taxpayer money, or is it going to be new capital raised in the markets?
That's your first question as to whether the tests are real and people believe them. If people in the markets and investors believe the tests give accurate information and the situation stabilizing, then new private money will come in. If, on the other hand, it's just the U.S. government converting the preferred shares they already have into common stock or adding money out of the TARP through some shell game, then it says the markets don't really believe it, and that's a bad verdict.
What hangs in the balance here? I mean, what depends on these grades? What will or won't happen when these grades are announced?
Ideally, what would happen if the tests were accurate is, yes, it would punish the stock prices of those banks that clearly are undercapitalized. It would lead to market pressure through the stock price, through other kinds of lending, on these banks to hurry up and get some capital, not yo-de-do, take 6 months to find it. And it would ideally free up lending from some of the other banks who, if markets believe these banks really got a clean bill of health, they could sort of go back to normal and go back to lending the way they used to.
Are we reading this right, that the government is negotiating with the banks over the state of these reports?
The government is grading on a curve, and a couple of the big banks are being grade grubbers. So they're whining about getting an easier touch on their exams than they otherwise would deserve. But in a sense, it's kind of beside the point because the whole test is aimed towards giving everybody a pass.
If we know, though, what the results are going to be, as you said, what's everybody waiting for? Why not just get it out on the table and let us know what the health of the financial sector is, and then we can either fix it and move on or have some really big crisis and move on?
Well, I don't think that the stress test is going to be the cause for the crisis, but that's not because the problem's fixed. The most cynical people would have said, oh, they're just going to say everybody's okay, and they would maybe ask for more capital for Citi since they already own such a big piece and pick one of the smaller of the 19 banks and let everyone else off. So they are being tougher verbally than some of the most cynical observers would have predicted. But it is kind of funny, what's the point of all this? Because, you know, they're doing it as though it's a technical fix, as though there's a specific number these banks need, whereas what they need is a political pushback, say, no more negotiations. You guys have to sell the stuff at prices you don't like.
Sell the stuff, these toxic assets, right?
Exactly, the bad assets on the books.
If in the face of the worst crisis in generations, the government can't do what it wants with regard to the banks, does that suggest to you that the banking industry is too powerful, has too many friends?
I think that's part of it. I think, yes, bankers have influence, but it's more they're trying to take advantage of the situation, that the government doesn't want failures, and the anger in the populace, because in the end, current bank shareholders and current bank management do best if nothing happens.
Adam Posen is the deputy director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. Adam, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Banks and builders led the way on Wall Street today, the way up, that is. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In bankruptcy court in New York City today, Chrysler asked for an early hearing into a sale of billions of dollars worth of its assets. Company lawyers say that would clear the way for Chrysler's proposed alliance with Fiat. Fiat executives, meanwhile, were in Germany today. They're trying to figure out how to take over General Motors' European operations. Not too long ago, Fiat was a down-on-its-luck Italian car company. But if everything it's working on now comes together, it will wind up as the second-largest automaker in the world. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that story.
9 years ago, high-flying GM bought a 20% stake in struggling Fiat and even made a down payment for an option to buy the whole company. But Brendan Moore, the publisher of Autosavant.com, says the Italian car company's earnings kept falling, and soon GM wanted nothing more to do with it.
In 2005, Fiat was almost bankrupt, and GM paid them $2 billion just to get out of the put option. How times have changed.
Fiat has engineered a dramatic turnaround under its new CEO, Sergio Marchionne, with Italian styles and better engineering. He sees an opportunity to market those new cars to Americans, says Pierluigi Bellini with IHS Global Insight in Milan.
Building a network, a distribution network, takes many years. And for example, there are many Japanese and Koreans that took like 10, 15 years to build a network. In the case of Chrysler, you already have 3,000 dealers over there.
Chrysler isn't the end of Fiat's ambition. Keith Crane, the publisher of Automotive News, says there are plenty of international automakers on sale these days.
The opportunity to buy Chrysler, the opportunity to buy General Motors Europe, and even General Motors Brazil are unbelievably good because of the poor global economy.
But he says Fiat's effort to become the Roman Empire of the auto industry is also risky, since the company is still burdened with plenty of debt from its brush with bankruptcy just 2 years ago. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
General Motors may not be far behind Chrysler. It needs billions more in government loans to survive and stay out of Chapter 11. But commentator Harley Shaken says GM is going about it all wrong.
The problem with GM's new Washington-mandated restructuring plan is that it steps on the gas in the wrong direction. Washington is at cross purposes. The stimulus package spends $800 billion to create jobs, while billions in loans to GM are conditioned on eliminating them. GM's plan seeks to save the company by shrinking it. In the U.S., GM will axe 23,000 factory jobs, 17 plants, and Pontiac, all in the next 3 years. What's more, the company plans to build 40% of the cars it sells in the U.S. offshore, up from 23% today, many in low-wage areas, say China. Well, what other options are there? The Auto Task Force should press for a bold plan to innovate, like accelerating the far better, more fuel-efficient vehicles already rolling off the assembly lines. How about a Pontiac with the sizzle of a 1967 GTO and the soul of a hybrid? It's easy to forget that GM has some of the most talented engineers, designers, and blue-collar workers in the world. What the company lacked is imagination and effective leadership. Consider Fiat. When the Italian automaker floundered in 2004, a new CEO, Sergio Marchionne, turned management inside out and introduced exciting, popular new models. The company began making money without closing plants or eliminating workers. Fritz Henderson, the new GM CEO, praised the government for acting like a private equity firm. A hedge fund wants to make money fast for its client, in this case the taxpayer, without regard to social cost. Unlike most clients, however, the taxpayer picks up the social cost. Longer unemployment lines and more foreclosures are devastating for the victims, not cheap for the rest of us. In the late 1950s, the legendary car maker Studebaker Packard sought to regain its luster through downsizing. It was so successful it no longer exists. The best use of taxpayer loans is a revitalized GM that creates jobs, not eliminates them.
Harley Shaken teaches labor and the global economy at the University of California, Berkeley. If you are actually in a car right now, you probably already know what I'm about to tell you. The traffic congestion is down, by one account, more than 70% in some areas. The price of gas has nothing to do with it. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports that unemployment might be the greatest highway decongestant of all.
Hear that? That's the sound of traffic moving in Los Angeles. It's becoming a more common sound, not just in L.A., but across the U.S. Scott Sedlick at the traffic monitoring company INRIX says congestion is down 29% nationwide. In fact, even before this year's job losses in 2008,
we experienced the biggest drop in overall traffic congestion since the oil crisis of the early 70s.
He says the reasons are fewer workers, less freight, and fewer non-essential trips by all of us. But the impact is adding up to an annual savings of 13 hours per commuter.
Having a very small difference in the number of vehicles on the road can have a huge impact on decreases in traffic congestion.
That's because on roads that have reached oversaturation, every car makes a difference. Michael Im drives every day from San Jose, California, to a train station. He then rides into San Francisco. It used to take him up to 2 hours.
Now it takes about an hour and 10 minutes to an hour and 20 minutes or so at the worst days. And I get a seat on the train, which is nice for my stress.
Still, the message from experts is don't get used to it. Here's David Ellis of the Texas Transportation Institute at Texas A&M University.
We tend to be creatures of habit, and eventually once the stimulus that has caused us to change moderates, we tend to get back to some sort of norm, if you will.
Luckily for me, that'll just mean packed subway cars. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
We've spent the past couple of Mondays on a special project, the poetry of all things economic, money and jobs and businesses. And when we asked for your favorites, the responses came pouring in. So instead of just one, we are going to hear three different poems today. They're all about the same thing, though. Work. Those who overdo it, those who underdo it, and those who can't afford not to do it. David Tucker's Downsizing explores the lead-up to a layoff.
Rumors are getting around. You've heard them. Little things in the hallway. One too many jokes about the company's stock. And the boss is whispering at the water cooler. Notice the secretaries? How little they talk now. They always know. And the offices upstairs stay lit all night. And don't tell me it means nothing that the junior executives who hate each other are going to lunch together. It won't be long. Some lucky bastard is about to get fired.
That's David Tucker reading Downsizing from the collection Late for Work, published in 2006. 30 years ago, Pedro Pietri wrote about a nearly universal experience, those days when you just don't have any work in you. Here's telephone booth number 905.5.
Woke up this morning feeling excellent. Picked up the telephone, dialed the number of my equal opportunity employer to inform him I will not be in to work today. Are you feeling sick? The boss asked me. No, sir, I replied. I am feeling too good to report to work today. If I feel sick tomorrow, I will come in early.
That was a recording of the late Pedro Pietri reading telephone booth number 905.5. There's nothing new about waking up feeling too good to work. That may have been the case for the men at play in Sarah Cleghorn's The Golf Links. Published in 1916, it describes watching a day off from the outside in.
The golf links lie so near the mill that almost every day the laboring children can look out and see the men at play.
That was poet and columnist Katha Pollitt reading Sarah Cleghorn's The Golf Links. If you want to hear more, go to our website. It's marketplace.org, and you can check out the rest of the series there. Coming up next week on Monday, how a poem helps one listener put the recession into perspective. Coming up, Germans size up American schools and their price tags.
I don't think American universities are better, some very famous like Harvard or Yale, only better for very rich people.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials soared 214 points today, about 2 2/3%, closed at 8,426. First close above 8,400 in more than 3 months for the blue chips. The NASDAQ raced up 44 points, more than 2.5%, finished at 1763. The S&P 500 shot up 29 points, roughly 3 1/3%, ended at 907, its first time above 900 since early January. Reports of higher construction spending and home sales sent investors knocking on the doors of home builders. Shares of KB Home rose about 11 2/3%. Stock and rival Toll Brothers climbed nearly 6.5% today. Investor optimism that results of government stress tests won't be too bad helped send bank stocks higher today. Shares in Wells Fargo surged nearly 24%. Bank of America jumped more than 19%. Shares of Boeing took off, that after the company announced its new 787 Dreamliner should be ready to fly this summer. Stock rose 2 1/3% today. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.15%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In New York, the Institute for Supply Management releases its non-manufacturing index for April. In Washington, President Obama meets with Israeli President Shimon Peres. And school dropouts are the focus of an educational summit at the National Press Club. Leaders in the field discuss re-enrolling high school dropouts. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Mexico is trying to bring its economy back to normal after 10 anxious days spent dealing with swine flu. Officials in Mexico City have lowered their threat warning. Schools are going to stay closed for another week or so, but cafes, libraries, and museums are going to reopen to the public day after tomorrow. Back here, a lot of people are still worried about the spread of the virus into their communities, even though the actual numbers on that might not add up. I asked behavioral economist Dan Ariely how come.
Yeah, that's right.
So long as you covered your mouth and you wash your hands after that, that's fine. Why is it that this flu has so captured the public imagination?
Here is the situation. It turns out that 36,000 people die every year in the U.S. from the flu. But the question, of course, is why don't we hear about the flu every day? If you say on average 100 people a day or more die from the flu, we don't hear about that. And all of a sudden we have this new flu that is making tremendous waves. And I think there are two reasons for that. One is that it's a mutation of a flu, so it actually has a potential to becoming very damaging. But the emotional reason, the reason that most people are afraid, is because we have identified a few cases of death and we report about them with great intensity. And what happened is that while statistical information, the number of saying 36,000 people die every year in the U.S. from the flu, is not as frightening as saying here is one person who died.
Does that correlate then on the political level as to why we don't have enough money set away for national pandemic prevention, why it's always, it seems like last minute we're trying to react to these things?
That's exactly the case. Because if you think about it, it's about when emotions get evoked. And it's very hard to be emotional about preventing disaster from something that hasn't happened yet. And one way to think about it is, imagine that you just bought a new suit. New pants, new shoes, new socks, everything is new. You spend about $1,000 on it. And you walk over a bridge and you see a person drowning. And you don't have time to get your new clothes off. You have to jump. And you know that if you jump, all your clothes will be ruined. Nobody would hesitate. You would waste $1,000 on that instant to save one person's life. Right. Whereas in reality, you could spend $3 in one day and save a kid from starvation or from malaria.
What does it say, though, that this disease seems to be so far so completely random? It's spread so wide, and yet some people aren't getting it and some people are.
And that's one of the reasons for fear. And you can make the parallel between this and terrorism. So if you think about, you know, more people die from driving car accidents than from terrorism, but people are much more afraid of terrorism than car accidents. And the question is why? And one of the reasons is that people feel they're in control. When people drive, they feel that they're holding the wheel and they're in control and they can prevent death or accidents. Where in fact, you can, to some degree, but not perfectly prevent it. Whereas terrorism looks random. It's completely outside of your control. And because of this, terrorism is overly scary from a probabilistic perspective. And I think the flu is a little bit like terrorism in a sense that you don't see it, you don't know where it's coming, you don't know where it's hiding, where it's lurking, and it creates this uncontrollable environment.
There is something, though, to the thought of, you know, there's not much I can do about this, so why get all worried about it?
If we could only do it this way, it would be fantastic. But we can't control what we're worried about. There's a beautiful experiment that was done many years ago where they were trying to get people not to think about white bears. And I challenge you to spend 5 minutes not thinking about white bears.
Yeah,
I
now it's impossible, right? That's all I'm thinking about.
That's right. So trying not to worry is most likely going to be counterproductive.
Dan Ariely, he's a professor of behavioral economics at Duke University. His book on the topic is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Last week was a big one for a lot of high school seniors. They had to make a final decision about which college they were going to go to. Now they and their parents have to figure out how to pay for it. Tuition at a U.S. public university can run more than $15,000 a year. For a private school, it's more than $25,000. In Germany, universities were only allowed to charge tuition at all a couple of years ago. Now, though, those fees are rising and students are protesting. In the southern state of Bavaria, they're going to take to the streets next week and call for fees to be scrapped entirely. As Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from Munich.
Georg, könnt ihr den Tisch?
The first day of term at Ludwig Maximilian University, Sebastian Erks and his friends are staging a symbolic protest. They've put up a series of steel hurdles by the university cafeteria, and they're inviting their fellow students to jump over them.
We're trying to say you're here at the university, and there are guys that actually don't want to have you here, so they're putting hurdles in your way.
Tuition here costs $1,300 US a year, the legal limit in Germany. Not much of a hurdle by American standards, but many of the students emphatically reject the American model. Stefan Liebel, who's studying politics.
I don't think American universities are better. Some very famous, like Harvard or Yale, only better for very rich people. The system in America, I don't like it.
The protesters claim that tuition fees deter thousands of young Germans from coming to university. There's not the same range of scholarships available here as in the US, and unlike American students, Germans are very reluctant to take out loans. Maria Dangwira has to work 2 days a week to help pay for her studies.
It's kind of annoying to know that other persons who don't have to work because their parents are rich, they can sit in library and study and I have to go to work. And sometimes I feel that I should study more, but I don't have the time to.
But education has to be paid for. Who do you think should pay for your university education if you do not pay it yourself?
I will pay. I mean, I will pay in the future when I earn money and I will pay my taxes. And I think it's the state who has to pay for education.
But others argue that higher education in Germany suffers because of its overwhelming dependence on the state. They say the German government doesn't invest enough. Strolling through the university's shabby main building confirms that impression. There's a dearth of teaching aids like projectors and DVD players. The American Studies Department couldn't afford maps of America. But with tuition fees, that's beginning to change, especially in the School of Medicine.
This is an arm, artificial arm, a model of an arm, to train how to take blood.
Elias Scaparo, a third-year medical student, is showing off some of the department's recent purchases funded by tuition fees. a dozen skeletons, an ultrasound imaging machine, and a life-size model of a child.
Well, you can train your reanimation skills, your basic life support skills.
Resuscitation.
Resuscitation, okay. You can... So you can...
So you're quite happy about tuition fees yourself?
Yes, I am, because it is improving my learning and I can learn better with all these equipment.
Even with tuition fees, this university is spending per student around $11,000 a year. That's half what many public universities in America spend. Professor Reinhard Herrmann is president of the Technical University in Munich. An ardent supporter of tuition fees, he sees them as part of a wider plan to wean German universities away from their total dependence on the state.
What we have to learn from the American system is competition. Competition is the number one thing to have to become successful.
Herrmann wants to get away from the traditional German idea that one university is as good as another. He wants his university to be part of a global elite, and that requires a lot more money from private as well as public sources.
We are the best-funded German university still, but we need to triple our budget in order to safely compete with places like Stanford, MIT, Georgia Tech.
To Germany's student protesters, this is anathema. The path to higher tuition fees, to ever-increasing student debt, and a widening gap between rich and poor. They'll be out on the streets of Munich again next week, calling for the fees to be scrapped. In Munich, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, we'll have a look at no-frills universities here in the United States as American schools try to cut tuition by cutting back on amenities.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, given the high and already rising costs of bailouts and economic stimulus, the government of the United States is in need of money, as you might have heard. It's already borrowing right up to its credit limit, so today the president came up with another idea. He's taking aim at companies and individuals that have been storing their excess profits offshore. Calling it just the first step in broader tax reform, the president says the IRS can clear $210 billion over the next 10 years if his plan becomes law. That's not going to be easy, though. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and congressional Republicans are already promising a fight. And that is Marketplace this Monday from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 214 points, 2 2/3%. The NASDAQ gained 44 points, more than 2.5%. The S&P 500 hiked up 29 points, 3 1/3%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the broadcast, a burger company that spreads the wealth.
Store managers that meet their goals. The company takes them on first-class trips abroad to Europe, Caribbean cruises. They're very generous.
And the burgers are good, too. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.